The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading from the Week magazine edition dated March 8th, 2013. And as usual, we will begin with the main stories section of the Week magazine. Our first article today is entitled, "The Blame Game Over the Sequester." Congressional Republicans and President Obama jockeyed to blame each other this past week for $85 billion in across-the-board spending cuts initiated by an automatic budget trigger called the sequester. As March 1st's sequester was due to kick in, the two parties were far apart on any deal to replace its mandatory cuts with either more targeted cuts or a mix of cuts and taxes. Instead, both sides maneuvered to win the battle of public opinion. The president said he was willing to negotiate a more sensible deficit reduction plan that would include tax reform, Medicare cuts, and new revenues from eliminating tax breaks for the oil industry and hedge fund millionaires, but blamed the sequester on Republican lawmakers who, he said, refused to compromise even an inch. But GOP leaders said Obama came up with the sequester in the first place during debt ceiling negotiations in 2011 and blamed him for causing the deadlock by demanding a second tax increase in 2 months. "The American people know if the president gets more money, they're going to spend it," said House Speaker John Boehner. The White House warned that the sequester's mandated spending cuts would result in longer security lines in airports, food shortages caused by reduced meat and produce inspection, and damage to the military's ability to defend the country. Republicans accused the White House of deliberately trying to make the cuts as painful as possible, instead of shifting resources within departments. A Pew poll found that 45% of the public would blame Republicans for the sequester, with 32% blaming Obama. Now here's what the editorial said. "It's a nanny state Armageddon," said the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. "Obama insists that the sequester will force him to close 100 air traffic control centers, cut 31,000 teaching jobs, and end preschool for 70,000 children. But the $85 billion in cuts represents about 2.2% of our bloated $3.8 trillion federal budget." "That's deliberately deceptive," said the Baltimore Sun. "The sequester only impacts discretionary spending, not the entitlements that make up the bulk of our budget. So the consequences are severe. How can Republicans insist on deep cuts for the national parks, schools, and food safety inspections while leaving $8 billion in oil industry subsidies untouched? Republicans have been utterly irresponsible in this debate," said the Washington Post. "But the president's being less irresponsible is hardly a comfort. Obama ought to be leading the way to sensible entitlement reform and deficit reduction, not joining in this stupid fight over a stupid budget issue." Now here's what the columnist said. "Both sides do not deserve blame," said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. "Obama has offered to negotiate a deal containing virtually everything Republicans say they want. Tax reform, $400 billion in Medicare cuts over 10 years, and more than $1 trillion in deficit reduction over that same period. And yet the GOP said no simply because the deal would include eliminating some tax deductions for the rich. Every other priority the party once had, including national defense, has been sacrificed to protect the rich from higher taxes. But once the pain of these cuts becomes very real, after April 1st or so, the brand damage will be undeniable, and defense hawks and party pragmatists will crawl out of the woodwork to cut a deal. Don't be so sure, said Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Government by freakout carries a price, and Americans will tire of President Obama's constant scare tactics. All the GOP wants is a comprehensive plan to reduce the deficit without more of Obama's class warfare-driven tax increases. That's not very radical. The next few weeks will be ugly, said Caroline Baum in the Bloomberg.com. All that matters to our political leaders is who gets what, who wins, who loses, and who gets blamed. In that context, maybe the sequester isn't such a bad idea. Once it kicks in, Congress and the White House will be forced to spread around the cuts sensibly, and the public interest will finally trump self-interest. It's about the dumbest approach to budgeting you can possibly imagine, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. But with this Congress, dumb is as good as we'll ever get. The next article is entitled Questioning Voting Rights Rules. The Supreme Court appeared poised this past week to strike down a key clause in the Voting Rights Act after the court's conservative bloc questioned whether black and other minority voters were still discouraged from voting in the South. Section 5 of the 1965 law aimed to end disenfranchisement of African American voters by requiring 9 mostly southern states and several smaller jurisdictions to seek preclearance from federal officials before changing any election procedures. At oral argument this week, Chief Justice John Roberts noted that black voters had higher turnout in Mississippi than in Massachusetts and pointedly asked, is it the government's submission that the citizens in the South are more racist than the citizens in the North? Liberal Justice Stephen Breyer said the disease of racism had gotten better since 1965, but is still there. Justice Anthony Kennedy, a frequent swing voter on a court divided along ideological lines, signals skepticism. The Marshall Plan was very good, too, he said, but times change. He's right about that, said Edward Blum in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks largely to the Voting Rights Act, the emergency that existed in 1965 is over. This unfair law fails to recognize the remarkable racial progress made by the Deep South since then, and the court should strike it down. How can one of the crowning achievements of the civil rights era now be hanging by a thread, asked Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. This is a supple law. Many jurisdictions, once subject to it, have established a proven record of non-discrimination and are no longer covered. It's up to Congress to decide whether it needs updating, but for the court, striking down Section 5 would be a truly radical move. We still need this law, said Representative John Lewis, a Democrat from Georgia, in the Washington Post. Even recently, it's been used to block photo ID laws and redistricting plans that were deemed intentionally discriminatory, the all-too-familiar southern jurisdictions that this law rightly places under special scrutiny, still have the most persistent, flagrant, contemporary records of discrimination in this country. Our next article from the main story section of the Week magazine, Hagel takes over the Pentagon. Chuck Hagel was finally sworn in as defense secretary this past week, bringing a bruising 8-week nomination battle to an end. The Vietnam veteran had faced fierce opposition from his former Republican colleagues, including a rare filibuster. As an outspoken critic of the Bush administration's handling of the Iraq War, Hagel was attacked by conservatives for his alleged hostility toward Israel. He once referred to a Jewish lobby on Capitol Hill and his soft position on Iran. A shaky confirmation hearing performance only added to concerns. But Republicans eventually relented. Soon after they broke their 12-day filibuster, the former Nebraska senator was confirmed in a 58-41 Senate vote, the narrowest margin for any defense secretary ever. Hagel may have the title, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com, but only a foolish White House would let him actually do the job. His disastrous confirmation hearing has left him with zero credibility, even on his own side. The process has been great for Republicans, clarifying our position against Hagel's egregious rhetoric and views. But it's been terrible for America. His confirmation will send a signal to Iran that we have a weakened defense and will worsen our relationship with Israel, which will now see the Pentagon as hostile and untrustworthy. True, the turbulent nomination has wounded Hagel, said John Soltz in HuffingtonPost.com, but he will eventually emerge stronger than ever. He already has authority with soldiers, having himself had his boots on the ground. He'll also be able to enjoy some groveling from those Republicans, John McCain and Lindsey Graham included, who opposed his nomination but who will now come to him to advocate for the various military installations or contractors in their states. Meanwhile, the GOP hurt itself with its unfounded personal attacks on Hagel. Now that the confirmation battle is over, said Spencer Ackerman in Wired.com, Hagel has a whole new gauntlet to run. The new Pentagon chief had just 3 days after taking office to figure out how to handle $46 billion in military budget cuts, thanks largely to the sequester. He'll surely have to knock some heads together to get that done, and that process should end all debate about just how dovish the new defense secretary actually is. Now from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week. It's entitled Obamacare. Is the GOP raising the white flag? Washington's repeal Obamacare crowd is feeling a little lonely these days, said Jennifer Habercorn in Politico.com. First, the Supreme Court betrayed them by finding the Affordable Care Act constitutional. Now, Republican governors in 8 states have bowed to political reality and agreed to accept the Affordable Care Act's optional Medicaid expansion. The biggest defection came last week in Florida governors Rick Scott, whose capitulation was followed this week by New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. For Scott to be waving the white flag is particularly galling, said Philip Klein in WashingtonExaminer.com. A former hospital executive and Tea Party favorite, Scott was among the ACA's fiercest opponents, at one point spending $20 million of his own money on ads denouncing President Obama's job-killing health care reforms. But now Scott has given up the fight, claiming he could not in good conscience deny the uninsured access to care. Conscience has nothing to do with it, says the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. This is all about money and political self-preservation. As an inducement for states to cooperate in providing universal health care, the ACA calls for the federal government to pay 100% of the cost of extending Medicaid to millions of the uninsured for the first 3 years, after which it tapers to 90%. Scott and Christie, facing budget issues, couldn't resist all that free federal magic money. But their cave-in doesn't mean the fight against Obamacare is over. When the full ACA kicks in next year, small businesses will start having to pay 20 to 30% more for their employees' coverage, at which point this huge new entitlement may explode on the launch pad. Besides, not all Republican governors have become collaborators, said NationalReview.com. At least 14 states have opted not to establish in-state insurance exchanges, leaving that daunting task to Washington. The dream of repealing Obamacare in full may be over, but the law's own design flaws may yet undo it. We don't need to repeal Obamacare to subvert it, said Douglas Holtz Eakin and Avik Roy in Reuters.com. Once the ACA starts driving health care spending to unsustainable levels, Republicans will have a chance to reshape our health care system to resemble Switzerland's, which provides universal coverage at less than half the cost of the U.S. system. The Swiss secret, citizens receive subsidies to buy their own private health insurance plans in a free market system that encourages competition. The architecture for a U.S. version of that system will be created by the ACA's insurance exchanges. If Republicans work to unburden the exchanges of the ACA's costly mandates and regulations, Obamacare can be transformed into a fiscally sustainable program that gives individuals a choice over competitive health plans. In other words, everything that conservatives have always wanted. Right, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. Obamacare is actually based on a Republican idea from the early 1990s to solve the problem of uninsured free riders on the system. Too bad Republicans didn't notice this until they spent the last few years screaming about socialism. Conservatives hated Obamacare for one reason only, which is that it ensures that all Americans have access to health care. The fact that the Republicans' focus is now shifting to improving Obamacare shows they finally understand that the struggle to preserve American exceptionalism in health care, America's standing as the sole advanced democracy without universal citizen access to medical care, is over. And now, to lighten the mood a bit, let's turn to the Good Week for Bad Week section of the Week magazine for this week. Our Good Week for section, first of all, it was a good week for tempting fate. After Australian billionaire Clive Palmer announced he would build a replica of the Titanic to ferry passengers across the Atlantic, Titanic 2 will be just like the original, except this time there will be enough lifeboats for everyone. It was a good week for Mr. Spock after Star Trek fans voted en masse to have one of Pluto's moons named Vulcan, after the pointy-eared character's home planet. The name will now be forwarded to the International Astronomical Union for a final decision. And it was a good week for sweet talk after an Australian physicist proposed marriage to his scientist girlfriend with a mock academic paper that included a graph showing happiness growing over time and suggested an indefinite continuation of the study. His girlfriend said yes, by the way. It was a bad week for John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, who referred in a speech to the nation Kyrgyzstan, which does not exist. Kerry meant Kyrgyzstan, but mixed it up with Kazakhstan. A lot of stands over there. And it was a bad week for Japanese claustrophobes, with the news that the latest trend in crowded, expensive Tokyo is tiny apartments the size of a horizontal closet. Gikishima rooms have a ceiling height of 4 feet, yet cost the equivalent of $586 a month. And it was a bad week for crime after an Indiana couple was charged with a felony for allegedly sneaking from one movie theater to the next at a multiplex. Police say that Delilah Harbin, 40 years old, confessed, "I know we done wrong," and said she and her husband were at a funeral all day and just were not thinking correctly. Now, from the Week magazine for this week, we'll turn to the briefing section. This one is entitled China's Cyber Warriors. An ongoing campaign of computer attacks on the U.S. has been traced to China. What are the hackers after? Who has been hacked? Government agencies, newspapers, utilities, and private companies, literally hundreds of targets. The cybersecurity firm Mandiant, which has been tracking these attacks since 2004, says data has been stolen from at least 140 companies, mostly American, including Google, DuPont, Apple, The New York Times, and The Washington Post, as well as think tanks, law firms, human rights groups, and foreign embassies. A company that provides internet security for U.S. intelligence was attacked. So was one that holds blueprints for the nation's pipelines and power grids. Hackers even stole classified information about the development of the F-35 stealth fighter jet from subcontractors working with the plane's producer, Lockheed Martin. Congressional and federal offices have reported breaches, too. In 2007, the Pentagon itself was attacked, and it won't say what was stolen. Who's doing it? 10 years ago, Chinese patriots working independently were behind many of the attacks. These young hackers were outraged by the 1999 U.S. bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Serbia, an accident during the Kosovo War. Using the name Hawkers, or Red Guests, they launched a series of denial-of-service attacks on U.S. government websites. But within a few years, some of them had begun working with the Chinese government, targeting Tibetan and Taiwanese independence groups, the religious group Falun Gong, and anyone in the West who communicated with Chinese dissidents. In recent years, says anti-malware specialist Joe Stewart, the number of hackers has doubled with 10 major hacking groups in China. There is a tremendous amount of manpower being thrown at this from their side, Stewart told Bloomberg Businessweek. China's government now appears to be directing the attacks. We've moved from kids in their bedroom and financially motivated crime to state-sponsored cybercrime, said Graham Cluley, a British security expert. Why is China doing this? China sees cyber warfare as a valid form of international business and military competition, and is pursuing what it calls information dominance. Mandiant has traced many of the U.S. attacks to a Shanghai office building that appears to be the home of the People's Liberation Army Cyber Warfare Unit. Thousands of hacks, including ones by two of the prominent aliases, Ugly Gorilla and Super Hard, were traced definitely to the district, and in recent years, that building has installed super high-tech fiber-optic cables able to handle massive data traffic. About 2,000 people are estimated to be working in that building. This group appears to specialize in English-language computers, and hackers seem well-versed in Western pop culture. One of the hackers used Harry Potter references for his passwords. China has issued a blanket denial, calling Mandiant's claims groundless and irresponsible. How do the hackers get access? Well, mostly by the technique known as spear phishing. They send an email with a link that an employee of a targeted company then opens, activating malware programs that sweep through databases, vacuuming up information, including emails, blueprints, and other documents. Some phishing, and that's spelled P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, some phishing emails are recognized as spam by the recipients. But the Chinese are getting better at disguising them, sometimes using email accounts with real people's names that are known to the recipient, and using colloquial English so the emails read as plausible company business. What does China do with the information? The corporate secrets are worth a lot of money to Chinese business. Blueprints of advanced plants or machinery could help many Chinese industries, and so could data on corporate finances and policies. Energy companies, for example, can benefit from knowing what their foreign competitors are willing to bid for oil field sites. Chinese companies have already been sued for allegedly stealing DuPont's proprietary method for making chemicals used in plastics and paint. More ominously, some of the information could be used to disrupt U.S. industry or infrastructure. And while China is the main source of attacks, other countries also frequently hack U.S. sites, including Russia, North Korea, and Iran. What is the U.S. doing to protect itself? Congress refused to pass a comprehensive cybersecurity act last year because of opposition from business groups, which complained that new computer regulations would be costly and onerous. As a result, President Obama recently issued an executive order requiring Homeland Security to identify critical infrastructure where a cybersecurity incident could reasonably result in catastrophic regional or national effects on public health or safety, economic security, or national security. Those companies will have to beef up their cybersecurity by installing multiple layers of protection for the most sensitive systems. Right now, some companies have only a single firewall, and once that is breached, all the data is available. The dirty little secret in these control systems is, once you get through the perimeter, they have no security at all, said Dale Peterson of security company Digital Bond. Hackers can do anything they want. And the footnote article here to this briefing section is entitled A Worst Case Scenario. Derailed trains. Air traffic control system suddenly shut down with thousands of planes in the air. Exploding chemical plants and gas pipelines. Blackouts over large parts of the country lasting weeks or even months. These are some of the apocalyptic events cybersecurity experts fear. Hacks that could kill people and sow widespread panic. But what might even be more damaging, the experts say, is a coordinated attack on multiple banks in which hackers alter, not wipe, much of the financial data stored on their computers. With balances, debts, and other data changed, no transaction would be trustworthy. Nobody's bank account or mortgage statement could be deemed accurate. It would be impossible to roll that back, said Dmitry Alperovich of the security company CrowdStrike. You could wreak absolute havoc on the world's financial system for years. Leon Panetta, the outgoing defense secretary, warns that hackers are now testing the defenses of banks, utilities, and government agencies and figuring out how to launch a paralyzing attack. This is a pre-9/11 moment, Panetta recently told business executives in New York. The attackers are plotting. And now let's turn to the best columns in the U.S., according to the Week magazine for this past week. Our first one is entitled, Let's Get the Truth About Guns, written by David Frum in CNN.com. Does owning a gun make you safer? Said David Frum. The gun lobby does not want you to know. All the available data strongly indicates that a gun is far more likely to be used to kill a family member in a suicide or in an accidental shooting than it is in defense against criminals. Gun makers and advocates challenge this data, just as the tobacco lobby once claimed there was no proof that smoking caused cancer. But under a law pushed by the gun lobby, Congress has forbidden the use of federal research dollars to study gun safety. Why? The answer is obvious. What we do know is that more than 15,000 people are shot each year in accidents, with more than 600 of these wounds proving fatal. That's more than all the people killed or injured in fires or plane crashes. Another 19,000 use guns to kill themselves. If any other product had this kind of safety record, we'd have a national uproar. President Obama should direct the Surgeon General to conduct an extensive study of gun safety, like the tobacco studies of the 1960s. Let's find out what guns really do to those who carry them. The next column is entitled Ignoring Syria's Misery by David Rode in TheAtlantic.com. The Obama administration's policy toward Syria is a failure, said David Rode. The president last year rejected a proposal from his national security team to provide some aid and armaments to those fighting a civil war with dictator Bashar al-Assad. And the result is a horrifying stalemate. At least 70,000 Syrians have died, 850,000 refugees have fled to neighboring countries, and pro-Assad military forces now mercilessly pummel rebel-controlled neighborhoods with airplanes, helicopters, Scud missiles, and artillery. Among the secular pro-Western rebels, there is both disbelief and disgust that America is deaf to their pleas for help. Meanwhile, Islamic extremists in the Middle East are funneling aid and weapons to jihadist elements in the revolution, while Iran and Hezbollah are propping up Assad in every possible way. Why won't Obama do anything? He's afraid. Afraid of getting pulled in too deep. Afraid that any arms the U.S. provides will wind up in the wrong hands. But these risks can be managed while doing nothing about a growing human tragedy is both immoral and strategically foolish. Our inaction will come back to haunt us. And the third column in this week's Best Column section, Jackson Jr.'s Shameful Letdown by Clarence Page in the Chicago Tribune. Even by the jaded standards of Illinois politics, said Clarence Page, the illegal spending spree by former U.S. Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. was breathtakingly shameless. The Illinois Democrat and his wife, former Chicago Alderman Sandy Jackson, pleaded guilty last week to spending $750,000 of campaign cash on a bonanza of goodies, including a gold-plated Rolex watch, a cruise, a cashmere cape, and two stuffed elk heads. "Tell everybody back home I'm sorry I let them down," Jackson said. Perhaps his bipolar disorder played a role in his reckless self-destruction, but let everybody down he did. When he entered politics, Jackson seemed to be a breath of fresh air in the corrupt, where's mine world of Illinois politics, which has seen half of the last eight governors and 31 aldermen convicted of crimes since 1973. Eloquent, hardworking, and charismatic, Jackson used to be touted as a possible candidate for mayor, governor, and beyond. Now he'll just be remembered for the Rolex and the elk heads. As the famous saying goes, never fall in love with a politician. They'll break your heart every time. And you're listening to our Reading of the Week magazine for the week March 8th, 2013. Thanks so much for joining me today. Now we will flip to the back of the magazine to the last word. And this week it's entitled, Man's Best Oxytocin Enhancer. Dogs may not be people, says John Homans, but there's a reason we think of them as members of our families. Stella's world is in turmoil. Not that you'd know it by looking at her. She's on her spot on the rug, looking at me, waiting for the next thing, as usual. All seems placid, a dog on a rug. But beneath this tranquil scene, large forces are at work. The very definition of who she is, what goes on in her head, how she should be treated, and what rights she might deserve have all been shifting rapidly. Today the dog world is in the throes of political and ideological convulsions of a kind not seen since Victorian times, when the dog as we know it was invented. Put simply, the dog is now in the process of being reimagined. I wasn't aware of any of this when she arrived in our home. Stella was, to begin with, just a dog, although in many quarters these days, just a dog are fighting words. But dogs have been moving into households in ever more intimate arrangements. Close to 100% of dog owners talk to their dogs, and the few who they don't must be lying. 81% view their dogs as family members, according to one study, and many of these family members sleep right in the bed, a privilege Stella didn't get and at any rate didn't seem to want. But she gets plenty of human privileges, starting with her diet, which features leftovers, sometimes, I'm sorry to say, straight from the table. A shockingly high number of people say that in certain life-threatening situations, they would save their pet before they would save a fellow human. Excuse me, I'm sorry. I hope I know what I'd do if facing that choice. But I'm glad I'm not likely to be put to the test. Because immediately Stella was a family member, we couldn't deny it. All of us spent a lot of time walking her, talking to her, analyzing and reanalyzing her quirks, her combustible mix of fear and excitement in the dog run, her dislike of the car, her abject terror of thunder, her varied and exuberant vocabulary. We worried about how she would spend the weekend if we weren't with her. Stella is an elegant creature with a high-gloss black coat and runway model's trick of looking simultaneously gorgeous and ridiculous. She's mostly a Labrador retriever, certainly in her goofball ways, but her splotchy purple tongue, curling scimitar tail, and brownish undercoat suggest chow blood, and sometimes I think there's a hint of pit bull in her muscular, slightly bulging cheeks. She's a lab, definitely, but also a mutt, although that word, with its whiff of contempt for the mixing of breeds, is used much less than it once was. I don't think of Stella as a person in any conscious way, yet I treat her as if she were a very unusual toddler. I endeavor to fill in the cartoon thought bubble over her head as well as I can. Sometimes the message is fairly clear. If she wants a run, she stands in front of me, ears slightly cocked, and fixes me with a hard stare, not angry, but very definite. If the delay is too long, sometimes an hour, sometimes 5 minutes, she unfurls an ululating whine, all O's and U's, the meaning of which is unmistakable. Why won't you take me? And that's just one of her communicative vocalizations. Stella's place in my household, with her preposterous human-like status, reminds me of Woody Allen's joke about relationships at the end of Annie Hall. A man goes to a psychiatrist complaining that his brother thinks he's a chicken, and when the psychiatrist suggests getting the brother some help, the man replies, "I would, but I need the eggs." An outsider looking at the place of dogs in our culture might think we were all suffering from some kind of mass delusion, but we definitely need the eggs. At a chemical level, it may not matter that the dog is not a person. An increasing amount of evidence points to oxytocin, the all-purpose bonding hormone, as the crucial mediator in these effects, exactly the same mediator that underlies many significant human contacts, including the bond between mother and child. A 2009 study found that people's urinary oxytocin spiked after interaction with their dogs. Increasingly, the length of the gaze was significant. Those who looked longer into the eyes of their dogs got a bigger dose. The gaze is fundamental to the interaction between mother and infant. It's the basic communicative building block. A dog's willingness to gaze at a human is also one of the basic differences between dogs and wolves. The role of oxytocin in a dog-human bonding has interesting corollaries. While the hormone increases trust and attachment, it apparently doesn't make people love everybody. In fact, it tends to reinforce the cohesion of our social groups, partly at the expense of outsiders. A Dutch study even found that the hormone can play a role in ethnocentrism. Oxytocin, the authors wrote, enhances not only in-group favoritism, but to a lesser extent, out-group derogation. The love for one's friends and family is accompanied by an increased dislike for those who are not in the group. This alarming yin and yang makes a lot of sense. I often wonder if I would save Stella before I'd save a stranger. I'd like to think not, and I hope never to have to choose, but it would certainly be something I'd struggle with. Dogs actually do pretty well at providing our needed eggs. A long and fascinating thread of research after 3 decades has demonstrated that dogs produce measurable positive health effects on people. Though many aspects to this research are still disputed, the stress-reducing power of dogs is increasingly acknowledged. A 1980s study of 92 patients who suffered either heart attacks or angina found that the patients with pets, any pet, even a snake, had measurably higher survival rates than those without. A larger study in 1995 came to a similar conclusion, except it found that dogs offered better results than other pets, possibly because they have to be walked. Beginning in the 1990s, Karen Allen, a psychology professor, performed a series of studies that further refined the picture of dogs' health benefits. In an ingenious experiment designed to find out whether dogs have an effect on everyday stress, she wired volunteers with electrodes and blood pressure monitors and had them count rapidly backward by 3s from a 4-digit number, a task that seems simple enough but is actually fairly challenging after a few repetitions. People's stress response when frantically counting backward was significantly reduced if a dog was on hand, even simply wandering the room, then if not. This oxytocin effect may broker the various health effects of dogs. Oxytocin is the body's stress reducer, calming people down and lowering their anxiety. Because our stress responses, so useful in dealing with conflict, are highly unhealthy over the long term. The oxytocin produced by petting our dogs may also help us live longer. One study found that children who are raised with a pet are more empathetic than those who aren't. The dog, no secret here, is also an excellent wingman. A 2008 study found that a man with a dog has a much better chance of getting a woman's phone number than one without. Dogs have also long been associated with people who are lonely or have trust issues, with misanthropes — Hitler was a dog lover — and with people with lots of money who think, perhaps accurately, that that's the only reason anyone could love them. Leona Helmsley's little dog, Trouble, the richest dog in the world until his death in 2011, is the obvious example. The only charitable cause specifically mentioned in Helmsley's will — her fortune was estimated at $5 billion at the low end — was to provide for the care of dogs. The document is testament to a moral impoverishment of mythic dimensions, the last bird the queen flipped at the people. A dog can be a last refuge for lost people. A kind of therapeutic solipsism is at work here in this type of relationship. The dog fits perfectly into this sort of calculus because its needs are so simple. And, of course, your dog doesn't know you're a narcissist. Loving a dog can be like looking into a mirror that strips away your bad qualities, your human spikes, reflecting only the pure, caring person you believe yourself to be. Relatedly, psychologists have confirmed what is obvious to anyone observing the dog's place in the modern world, that loneliness amplifies our propensity for anthropomorphism. In the absence of people to interact with, we transmogrify our dogs into people. It's easy to think, looking at canines like Helmsley's Trouble, that dogs are a species of emotional con men, wheedling their way into the hearts of weak people and extracting their bounty, whether it be a huge fortune or an extra piece of steak and a place in the bed. John Archer, an evolutionary psychologist, has gone so far as to suggest that dogs are social parasites. Pets, he wrote in a 1997 paper, can be considered to manipulate the human species. They are similar in this regard to social parasites such as the cuckoo. The affection, food, and time and energy devoted to a pet is not repaid in terms of related offspring, and it could have been more profitably spent caring for human offspring and relatives. Archer judged our relationships with our pets as maladaptive behavior, and though his argument is about evolution rather than about the day-to-day life with animals, it tends to reinforce the notion that there is something amiss with these increasingly intimate relationships. Archer suggests that the infant schema of a dog's face, essentially the high forehead, big eyes, short snout, and floppy ears, might have evolved to take advantage of humans' innate responses. These features elicit a human caregiver's response, but there are an abundance of dispositive arguments one might make against Archer. For one thing, the spreadsheet over the centuries also contains many reasons humans choose to have dogs: for hunting, herding, and guarding. But the simplest reason might be because we want to. Dogs are a part of human culture in a way that is not reducible to simple calculations of cost and benefit. Somehow they're involved, like art or religion, in our higher functions. Stella is, for me, more than the sum of her cost in dog food. Sometimes I thought people like Archer wanted to wish away the presence of dogs in our homes, all an illusion, nothing to see here. But the contrary evidence was right there on the rug. Stella was more than a trickster. She was a friend, less communicative than those in my human circle, but this gave her her own distinctive excellences. Whatever Archer's intentions, I could concede that he was right, that somehow by design or by evolutionary accident, dogs have become sublimely suited for life with us. They've been part of our ecosystem for millennia, and we are the central feature in theirs. And this article was reprinted by arrangement with the Penguin Press. From What's a Dog For? The Surprising History, Science, Philosophy, and Politics of Man's Best Friend by John Homans. Now, from The Last Word, we'll head to the Health and Science section of The Week magazine. Our first article, Using DNA Tests to Diagnose Illness. DNA testing to identify disease-causing mutations used to be too expensive and time-consuming for use in diagnosing individual patients. But with the cost of such DNA sequencing dropping, a growing number of parents of children with mysterious disabilities are turning to tests for both diagnosis and possible treatments. The New York Times reports the tests in which scientists sequence all of a patient's genes now cost less than $9,000 and are often covered by insurance. Most people originally thought of using it as a cord of last resort, says Columbia University pediatrician Wendy Chung. Now we can think of it as a first-line test. The test is no panacea. It detects a genetic abnormality in about 30% of cases and leads to better management of disorders in only 3%. But for many parents who have spent years seeking explanations for their children's disabilities, gene sequencing can offer relief and sometimes even more. Twins Alexis and Noah Berry, for example, were 14 when sequencing revealed a mutation that was preventing them from synthesizing the neurotransmitters dopamine and serotonin, causing tremors and difficulty breathing. The problem was quickly treated with drugs, and 3 weeks later, one of the twins began running track. Most families aren't that lucky, cautions William Gale of the National Institutes of Health. We try to make expectations realistic. The next item, better parenting through TV. The average American preschooler watches more than 4 hours of TV a day, well over twice the screen time experts recommend. But now a new study suggests that what they watch could matter more than how much they watch. Researchers divided the parents of more than 500 children ages 3 to 5 into two groups. They gave half of them advice on choosing pro-social children's shows that stress kindness and cooperation, such as Sesame Street, while allowing the other half to continue their kids' normal TV routines, which often included violent shows like Power Rangers. After 6 months, the children who had watched the pro-social programming had become demonstrably less aggressive toward others, despite watching roughly the same amount of TV as their peers. The difference was especially pronounced among low-income boys, who are most at risk of being victims and perpetrators of aggression, study author Dimitri Christakis of Seattle Children's Research Institute tells Time.com. The study comes on the heels of another one which found that every hour of TV kids watched on an average weeknight increased their risk of landing in prison as adults by 30%. It's hard to imagine seeing the same results if they had just watched PBS documentaries, says Christakis. And the next item, restoring lost sight. People who've lost their eyesight to a common degenerative disease can now see again with a newly developed bionic eye. Using a video camera mounted on eyeglasses, the Argus II system captures visual information, then beams it to electrodes implanted in the retina, which conveys image-forming signals to the brain. The system lets people stricken with retinitis pigmentosa, a disease that damages retinal cells and affects about 100,000 Americans, distinguish light from dark and recognize large objects and letters. The 50 participants in the clinical trial for the device reported that they could spot curbs, crosswalks, people, and cars, and sort white socks from black. Without the system, I wouldn't be able to see anything at all, Elias Konstantopoulos, a retired electrician and one of the trial's participants, tells the New York Times. When you have nothing, This is something. It's a lot. Researchers now hope to improve the system to let people see more detail and in color. Now we'll move to the Talking Points section of the Week magazine for this week. Our first article, The Vatican Rocked by New Scandals. The Catholic Church was still in shock over Pope Benedict XVI's sudden resignation, said Ben Wendeman in CNN.com, when a fresh wave of scandal last week threatened to eclipse the poignancy and pageantry of the Pope's final days in office. First came reports from an Italian newspaper that a clique of gay priests within the Vatican was being blackmailed by a group of male prostitutes, a claim the Vatican denied. Then Cardinal Keith O'Brien of the United Kingdom, known for harsh anti-gay rhetoric, was accused by three priests and one former priest of inappropriate acts. O'Brien was allowed to resign the very next day. With the church reeling, other cardinals are now heading to the Vatican for what may well be the most important conclave in centuries, said John Cass in the Chicago Tribune. Their duty, choosing the right pope at a dangerous time. The Vatican's troubles go very deep, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. The report of a secret gay cabal within the higher ranks of the church emerged from the Vatican's own investigation of the so-called VatiLeaks affair, the leaking of internal documents to the press last year by the Pope's personal butler. The investigator's 300-page report paints a picture of a deeply factionalized Vatican rift with bribery, nepotism, and influence peddling. At the heart of these scandals is the Catholic clergy's breathtaking hypocrisy, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. The church hierarchy remains in stubborn denial about the destructive impact of priestly celibacy and of its arbitrary and backward ban on women priests. That misguided clinging to medieval dogma and the participation of the outgoing pope and some of his cardinals in the cover-up of the church's child rape scandals has robbed Rome of its moral authority. To regain it, the church needs to face the truth about itself and find a brave, dynamic pope who can make a fresh start. Perhaps the change is already underway, said Paul Valley in independent.co.uk. Instead of being silenced or ignored, the priests who spoke up about Cardinal O'Brien were heard by Rome, and O'Brien was immediately sacked by the Pope. Benedict's successor needs to encourage this new atmosphere of openness and accountability, said Walter Russell Mead in RealClearPolitics.com. With a firm hand and fresh ideas, he can drag the church, kicking and screaming, into a new and better day. Our next article is entitled Google Glass Wearing the Internet. Google Glass is no longer a rumor, said Tim Parker in Forbes.com. It's real. The company unveiled a prototype of its internet-equipped eyeglasses last week, announcing that it would give a selected bunch of bold, creative individuals the chance to purchase the first version this year for $1,500. The futuristic spectacles have a tiny screen located in the top right-hand corner of the frame, where web data can be projected in front of the user's eyeball. Using voice-activated technology, you can do a Google search, call up GPS directions, video chat with your friends, and even record what you're seeing with a tiny mounted camera, all without fumbling for a cell phone. Welcome to the future, said John Moltz in Macworld.com. Wearable computing technology is finally here. And now a few short items as we reach the end of our program for this week. Since the Newtown, Connecticut massacre, at least 2,268 Americans have been killed with guns, including 158 children and teenagers. All the nagging about the unhealthiness of fast food may be paying off. Between 2006 and 2010, the proportion of the nation's total caloric intake that came from fast food outlets dropped from 12.8% to 11.3%. Nearly 60% of the tuna sold at restaurants and grocery stores in the U.S. is not tuna, a DNA study by the group Oceana found. Most of the mislabeled tuna was, in fact, an extremely oily fish called escalar, known to cause diarrhea. The same study found that red snapper was misrepresented 87% of the time. Breast implant surgery fell by 7% in 2012, but overall plastic surgery procedures grew by 5%. The biggest growth was in Botox injections and other procedures to smooth facial wrinkles as baby boomers aim to conceal the evidence of their advancing years. About 6.7 million students are currently enrolled in online college courses. Only 10% of those students will finish them. And in retirement, Pope Benedict will continue to wear the Pope's white cassock, live in the Vatican, and will be called the Emeritus Pope. And now we'll take a look at the poll watch and a related item here. 74% of U.S. Catholics have a favorable opinion of Pope Benedict XVI, even though 63% rate his handling of sexual abuse in the church as fair or poor. And now a couple of quotes from the Wit and Wisdom column. A man always has two reasons for what he does, a good one and the real one. That was J.P. Morgan, quoted in the Huffington Post. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it without a sense of ironic futility. That was filmmaker Errol Morris, as quoted in the Los Angeles Review of Books. To succeed in life, you need three things: a wishbone, a backbone, and a funny bone. And that was a quote from Reba McEntire, quoted in the Fort Scott, Kansas Tribune. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next week. We certainly hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.